Hello, everyone. It's Dan Bossi, Ag Resource Company, starting up a brand new podcast here called Old Men Do Grain. Now, the reason we gave it this name is because of the wisdom that comes with years of experience of being in the grain business. I grew up in a farm and then, of course, started Ag Resource back in 1987. So I'm pleased to be joined today by Dr. Bill Tierney. Bill, you've been in the grain business longer than I have. I think if we add it all together, we may be approaching 100 years. Hopefully, the listenership from this will have some wisdom. But the podcast is started to enlighten upon people who have been in the grain business a long time, but also imparting their wisdom in terms of what the markets are doing today and maybe a little bit of visibility of what they show going forward. Bill, how are you today?
I'm great, Dan. I'm certainly enjoying this very pleasant spring morning. A little bit cool for my taste, but I'll take it because the sun's shining.
Bill, how long have you been in the grain business? I know you've worked in so many locations, including USDA as their chief grain analyst in terms of WASDE. When did you start?
Well, if you don't count the 6 years I spent in graduate school, my first official ag economics job was in 1981. When I finished up my PhD program at Michigan State University, and I went to work for the Pillsbury Company in Minneapolis. At the time, the Pillsbury Company was noted in the food industry for having a very disciplined approach to commodity price risk management. They had a commodity analysis department, and every Thursday there was a meeting between the commodity analysts sitting on one side of a long conference table and all the commodity buyers on the other side of the conference table. And there was an overhead projector at the end of the table. And one by one, each analyst for every commodity would get up and do their presentation and basically make a recommendation, go long, go short, hold our position steady, go long basis, go long futures at the time. There were no option contracts. And some commodities only had cash contracts. And then the buyer would get up. And the buyer would say, well, the analyst doesn't know a thing about what's in the market. Let me tell you what all my contacts in the industry are telling me. And it got to be, it could be a very heated meeting. So I did that for 2 years. I learned a lot about commodity markets and commodity price risk management. And my area of responsibility there was I was the wheat analyst, the flour analyst, and I did a little bit of rice and a little bit of cocoa. But after 2 years, there was a position that opened up at Kansas State University for an extension grain marketing specialist in the department. And I applied for that and I got the position. And I was at Kansas State University for 20 years. I left there in 1983 and took a position with USDA in the World Agricultural Outlook Board. And as you know, Dan, and I think our listeners know, the Outlook Board is the principal agency that pulls together the monthly WASDE report, the World Agriculture Supply Demand Estimates. And it's the World Board's responsibility to pull that together using the collaboration of individual specialists in Economic Research Service, in the Foreign Ag Service, in the Ag Marketing Service. And I can't think, I think there was one or two other agencies that had people participating in the process. So I was there at USDA for 3 years. And then I left and went to work as the principal economist for a boutique brokerage firm, John Stewart Inc., and they worked predominantly with ethanol plants, and they focused almost entirely on the corn market, corn basis, corn spreads, and DDG markets and DDG cross-hedge relationships, as well as ethanol prices. I did that for 2 years. Then I went to work for a international agribusiness consulting firm called LMC International. And they are located, they're headquartered out of Oxford, England. And I worked for them for a year, working on a number of different consulting projects, many of them focused on biofuels, the projects. But there was one project I remember that focused on a company that wanted to get into the Black Sea grain business. And I remember quite well that my recommendation was that there was too much geopolitical risk, and doing business in Russia was fraught with all kinds of financial risk, not just geopolitical risk. I recommended that they not do it, but they didn't take my advice. They went into business, and now they're out of business there. So I had a number of other things that I did after that. I worked at Black Sea, at Black River, which was a hedge fund run by Cargill. I also spent a year in northern Iraq working for the U.S. military, U.S. State Department, and USDA as an agricultural advisor to the provincial ministry of agriculture in northern Iraq in the province of Kirkuk. I finished up there in 2012, and then, or was it 2011? And then I came to work for you, Deanne, and I've been here for 13 years this fall.
Well, thank you, Bill. It's quite an illustrious career you've had, and your knowledge and your work is something that the industry has always respected, starting at Kansas State and finishing up here at Ag Resource. You know, as you look back at the markets and you think about where we've been and where we're going, is there anything that glaringly stands out to you as something that's changed over your, my calculation is 52 years of being in the grain business?
Well, Dan, you know, when I think about that, my first commodity, the one I spent a tremendous amount of time on, was wheat. And at that time, when I started off, the U.S. was the world's largest wheat exporter, accounted for, I think, roughly 55% of global exports, maybe some years more than that. And the world's largest importer of wheat was the former Soviet Union. And now, the former Soviet Union no longer exists. The world's largest empire no longer exists. And the former Soviet Union, Russia, Ukraine, and Kazakhstan in particular, are now the world's largest exporter. And if just Russia is the world's largest exporter of wheat. And I think the U.S. has slipped to third or fourth largest exporter, and I think only accounts for about 20% of global wheat exports. So I would say that is the clearest example of how the markets have changed. But something similar in terms of the declining relevance of U.S. supply and demand to the global market, that phenomenon has extended beyond just the wheat complex and is clearly having an effect in the soybean complex, as well as somewhat less so in the feed grain complex.
So, Bill, you've worked with USDA at WASDE, and you know, in my career of 44 years, not quite as much as yours, I always see the bashing of USDA because people think they're politically minded or the numbers are being somehow pushed in favor of something or someone. While you were there, did any of that ever happen? And when you left, did you have a very high credibility of USDA and all the work that they do?
Well, Dan, if you haven't been there, you don't really understand how the numbers are put together and what the guiding principles are. And so you tend to be suspicious. You tend to be skeptical. And I'll have to admit, I was one of the bashers of the USDA prior to going to work there. In fact, when I talked to Keith Collins, who was the chief economist of USDA and the person who had the key decision in hiring me, I was somewhat surprised that he definitely wanted to hire me. And he said, we need to have somebody from outside. We need new blood. We need a different perspective. And once I got there, I have to admit, I learned more from the USDA and from my 3 years of experience there than whatever I had contributed to the agency and to its role. I totally understand why there is suspicion about USDA reports. And I think the first thing to keep in mind is that the production reports and the stocks reports are totally a function of the National Agricultural Statistics Service, or NAS. The World Board gets no idea what those numbers are until the lockup. So the World Board, for example, we have in May, we have the first winter wheat crop report, which NAS will conduct. And it'll be up to the wheat committee of the World Board to take that number and combine it with all of the other numbers that the World Board is responsible for. What they're responsible for is demand in the U.S. and production and demand everywhere else in the world. But any number that involves U.S. production or U.S. stocks has to be taken directly from NAS. The World Board does have some flexibility on whether or not they accept planting numbers or harvested numbers. But they absolutely have to take production numbers and stocks numbers. So the World Board should never be accused of having a low production number or a low stocks number, because it's not their number, it's NAS. But everything else, all the demand numbers, all the global supply and demand numbers, and the price forecast, that is the responsibility of the wheat committee itself. And again, when you think about, is there a political agenda? Did somebody tell them to come up with that number? Does that number in any way give an advantage to the administration? When I was there, there was a firewall that was built around the entire lockup process, as well as any preliminary work that went ahead of time. There was a federal law that was passed. I don't know when, but I was educated as to its existence as soon as I went to work for USDA, that if anyone who served on the committee itself revealed any of the preliminary information to anyone else outside of the committee, and by that I mean another USDA employee who was not a member of the committee, you can't reveal to them, well, you know what we're going to do? We're going to increase cotton exports by 15% in the next WASD. They couldn't do that. They could have these discussions within the committee that had members from the Foreign Ag Service, ERS, and the Ag Marketing Service. They could have discussions within the committee, but it was a federal law that they could not have discussions or reveal information outside of the committee, much less talk to somebody in the trade. And I can actually recall there was one occasion when I was at USDA that there was an investigator from USDA that called me up and said, I'm trying to find out if people in the industry had any information about a report. And I had to say, working at Kansas State at the time, that I hadn't. So USDA takes very seriously even rumors that there was information revealed before the lockup process. And my understanding, well, when I was there, that is that it had never happened except 100 years ago with regard to a cotton report. And I didn't see any evidence of it. And since I've left USDA about 17 years ago, I've stayed in contact with many of the people that are there and the new people that have come in. And again, I've never seen any indication that there was an early release of the information or that they were cooking the numbers to give an advantage to the administration. Now, I never saw any indication of that at all.
I'm glad you cleared that up, Bill. I give USDA the highest marks in terms of what they do. We may not always agree with their numbers, and we can point fingers back and forth, but I think at the end of the day, their work ethic, their methodology, how they do things, and the resources that they have and we don't have is so impressive that they are still, I don't want to say God in the grain industry, but one of the gods in the grain industry.
I agree, Dan. My experience before going to USDA, the 22 years before I went to USDA, and the time since I've left USDA, is that almost all discussions I've ever had with anyone about what is the price of corn going to be, what's the price of wheat or soybeans, it's always started with, well, the USDA says this. So the USDA is the benchmark that people begin their conversations about where is the market going, what's going to change, what's the price going to do. And we also have to understand that the USDA has a different perspective about price forecasts and supply and demand than most market participants. Most market participants are either trading the market or trying to deal with commodity price risk that's an inherent part of their business. You're either a trader or you're a hedger. And therefore, you're following the markets every day, thinking about what does this mean for price, because it's your bottom line that's at stake. The USDA doesn't have a bottom line, and their reports were originally for the purpose of Congress and the development of an agricultural budget. There was a time, 30, 40, 50 years ago, when agricultural spending, federal agricultural spending, was a very significant part of the total U.S. federal budget. And agricultural politics was a very important part of the political scene. So their focus is not so much to meet the needs of day traders and not so much to meet the needs of farmers and food companies that are trying to hedge risk. Their focus is on a much longer term period of time. And that's the reason why they, except for livestock, they only produce a single season average price for wheat, corn, and soybeans, whereas they have quarterly price forecasts for livestock. So their focus is certainly of a longer time span, that they say we want to get the figure right once a month rather than once a day or once a week. We want to get the figures right once a month. So they always look like they're lagging behind developments, because they are, because they only produce those reports once a month, and they don't respond to market developments that occur between the 30 days between reports. So they are always behind compared to everyone else in the market, just for that reason.
Your points are good, Bill. The only report they seem to be ahead is the May report, that May WASDE is coming out on the 12th of May this year. I only say that because it's a starting point in terms of global crop production, the incorporation of the March intentions reports, and all of this to come up with production stocks and totals. So I guess where I'm taking you here is, we're now with you, all the work you do every day, the tremendous amount of statistical labor that goes into your numbers, as you see the markets falling off sharply here in the end of April, what do you tell the audience, the listenership, the farmer, the end user? If you're in that meeting in back in your early days at Pillsbury, and you're the wheat analyst or the corn analyst or the soybean analyst, is there something from a visionary standpoint you could leave them with as we head into a growing season?
Well, one of the things I learned at USDA, probably the most important thing, is I learned about global agriculture supply and demand. Up until that time, and that was about 2003 that I went there. Up until that time, if you could lock down U.S. supply and demand balance sheets for wheat, corn, and soybeans, you got really close to what the U.S. price would be, and in turn, what the global price would be. The reason for that is because the U.S. remained the world's dominant exporter, if not the largest exporter, and also because of the influence of our markets, specifically our futures markets, which everybody in the world tend to use as one of the factors when they are trading commodities. So it was the size of U.S. exports and the influence of our price discovery markets that combined gave the U.S. Its leadership. Now, that's not the case anymore. And as a consequence, I tend to look at global supply and demand first before I look at U.S. supply and demand. And in the global supply and demand outlook, we are currently in this year at the tightest level for stocks to use for wheat and for corn, and nearly one of the tightest or close to the tightest level for oilseeds, specifically for soybeans. And there is a reasonably accurate relationship. It's not perfect by any means, but there's a reasonably good relationship between global stocks to use ratios. And by global, I mean, I focus on the stocks to use ratio of major exporters, not the entire world and not the world minus China, but just the major exporters. In the case of soybeans, there's basically three, Brazil, United States, and Argentina. In the case of wheat, there's eight. And in the case of corn, there's seven different countries. And what I spend a lot of time on is looking at a combined supply-demand balance for those major exporters, and specifically what the stocks-to-use ratio is. And what I see in this year is we are at the tightest level for exporters stocks-to-use ratio for wheat, corn, and nearly one of the tightest levels for soybeans. And what that tells me is that we're sitting on a powder keg. In fact, I think Andrei Sizov, who is the director of Sovicom, I saw him talking about the wheat market about a month ago. And the quote was, "The world wheat market is a powder keg, and the stocks are extremely tight. And global export demand is at a record high level, up from last year. Should a spark occur, that powder keg could go off." And so taking into consideration that I look at the global situation first for guidance as to what the market's going to do, I see nothing but a lot of risk to the upside. To the downside, there are always factors. For example, the supply-demand, the numbers that we think are accurate turn out to be inaccurate. It could be that stocks are larger than currently estimated. It could be that demand is less than currently estimated. And then we have all of next year's production to think about. So if we were considering that we're going to see new record global production by, let's say, 3 to 5% of feed grains next year, or of wheat, or of soybeans, people might say, so what if we're tight? We go into next year and we have an abundant supply, and the market's going to be fine. So it's not the be all and the end all in terms of how do you interpret market developments, but it's where I begin. And right now, we are dealing with a powder keg situation, particularly in wheat and in feed grains, and we could see very, very tight stocks in soybeans. Now, the prospects for next year are that exporter ending stocks of wheat are expected to be lower. Not higher, but lower. So that's not good, because when you plug in trend yields for wheat and you plug in the acreage figures that people are using now, it looks like next year's wheat stocks to use ratio is going to be even lower than it is this year. For feed grains, if you use 92 million acres of U.S. wheat planted, and if you use a record yield of 181 bushels, then we start to rebuild stocks in the United States, and that contributes to an increase in stocks among major exporters. In the case of soybeans, it's next year's Brazil's crop, Argentine crop, and the U.S. crop. And those are all in play right now. But I'm really concerned about the wheat market, because we're looking for a significantly lower Russian crop, and we're looking for a lower U.S. crop. And we're very much concerned about El Nino's impact on the Australian crop. I would say of the three commodities, the one that has the greatest risk, I'd say over the next 6 months, is the global wheat market.
Well, Bill, I think you're right. And you stated wheat, and I think you meant corn on balance sheets. When you say that, to me, the U.S. corn balance sheet is the only bear in the room, because stocks are increasing. If you look around Ukraine or Argentina or even Brazil, I don't think numbers are big enough there to justify where December corn is. This market is starting to trade new crop pretty aggressively, but 530 or under December corn seems too cheap, and you know, something like 12.5 for November beans. But the wheat market, to your point, boy, does it seem cheap with July Chicago now approaching 625 a bushel. So we'll see how that all plays out. But you know, I really enjoyed discussing the markets and getting some attributes from you and your long and illustrious career. I think these grain markets are going to stay to be very volatile in the year ahead. I don't know. Would you agree with that? Or I when I hear powder keg, it gets me on the edge of my chair.
Well, that was not my idea. That was Andrei Sizov, who's sitting there in the Black Sea and is a frequently quoted analysts, particularly with respect to the Russian situation. I've been trying to look at ag markets for over 40 years now. And in that 40-year time period, there was the Malvinas or Falkland War. At the early stages of that war, there was talk that maybe British submarines will put an embargo, a military embargo, on all trade in and out of Buenos Aires or in and out of the Platte River. But they didn't. What they did instead was they put an embargo around the Falkland Islands. I can remember that time we didn't have any of the resources we have now, but I went to the library and I was going through Jane's Military Encyclopedia. It's one of the first resources that was available for saying, well, how many airplanes does Argentina have? What kind of airplanes do they have? What kind of weapon systems do they have? Like, for example, they had the French Exocet missile, which was a ship killer. I remember that. I remember Chernobyl. I remember when the U.S., the Korean airliner was shot down by a Russian jet when it strayed off course, and there was a U.S. congressman on board. I remember, Chernobyl, the assassination of Anwar Sadat. There are numerous things, geopolitical events that have occurred that have shook up the crop markets. But I can't think of any other time when we've had so much geopolitical risk as we have today, and not just from the Black Sea. somewhat from the Black Sea. We have in Turkey, we have President Erdogan, the strongman leader of the Turkish Republic. He has got an election coming up in mid-May. He's been a key player in the Black Sea Grain Accord. He's been a key player in terms of diplomatic talks between the Ukraine and Russia, not the Ukraine, but Ukraine and Russia. But supposedly he had a bout of stomach flu the other day. He's got the election coming up. If he is not reelected, there is the possibility there could be dramatic changes in Turkey's foreign policy. There could be dramatic changes in Turkey's economic policy. And what we've seen from Erdogan and his party is that the Turkish economy is in dire straits. Turkey is a major geopolitical factor in not only the Black Sea, but in Central Asia and in North Africa, with Israel and Egypt both. That could be something that could change in 2 weeks' time and add a new element of uncertainty. Turkey is also the largest importer of Russian wheat. We also have a tremendous political crisis in Israel. Israel is at the same time pursuing a long-term policy of trying to prevent Iran from having nuclear weapons, restating over and over again, Iran will never have nuclear weapons. But now we have an Israeli government that has got its back pushed against the wall because of domestic political issues. And at the same time, Iran supposedly is within the technical capability of 2 to 3 weeks of having sufficiently pure enough uranium to produce an atomic weapon. So would a regime in Israel that has got its back to the wall, which is pursuing the long-term Israeli strategy of no nukes in Iran, is something going to happen there? Certainly, I think the risk is greater today than it was at any other time in the past. Iran itself has its back to the wall. Then we have the entire situation in Asia with Taiwan, with North Korea, with China being an ally of North Korea, with China being the country that's threatening to invade Taiwan. China is the world's largest importer of wheat. The last 2 years, they were the world's largest importer of corn. I think this year, the largest importer of wheat and corn. And certainly, I think they take about 60% of soybeans. So U.S. relations with China are possibly at the worst level they've been in decades. So I find that it usually is weather that is the biggest risk factor in crop commodity markets. And I would have to put, I'd say over the last 18 months and probably for the next 2 or 3 years, geopolitical risk is going to match weather as a risk factor or come very close to matching. So I would say we're going to see some of the greatest volatility, even more volatility over the next 2 or 3 years than what we've observed over the last 18 months when we saw record prices.
Well, Bill, we sure agree with you here at Ag Resource in terms of a commodity super cycle, because there's so many things that are affecting supply, demand, geopolitics, that the volatility of these markets is going to be extreme, both up and down, and everybody needs to be prepared for that. You know, Bill, I just want to thank you for being on the program, for all the work that you have done, for your service to the USDA and the U.S. in terms of Iraq. You've had an amazing and illustrious career, and what I find amazing about you is every day to this point, you're able, anxious, and ready to get at it. And so not many people, I would say that, at our old age in terms of men doing grain, but thank you for what you do.
Well, thank you very much, Dan.
This ends the first recording, and I want to thank all of you for coming. I hope you learned a lot. These are markets that are going to be extremely volatile going forward. I think the vision is there. Be prepared. We may be making major lows very quickly in Chicago. Thanks again.